Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film. Welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
Hello, and our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hi.
And this is a momentous occasion, isn't it, lads? Because we're actually in the same room together for the first time in 2 years.
That's amazing.
I mean, look at your lovely glowing faces.
I could reach out and touch you.
We could do that.
It's COVID safe to do so.
We are being COVID safe. So this is a joy. And this week we've got plenty to chat about. We're talking to Noomi Rapace about her new film, Lamb. Plus, we're reviewing that and Spielberg's West Side Story, Sorkin's Being the Ricardos, McKay's Don't Look Up, and Christmas cancer tragicomedy Hope. That sounds terrible, doesn't it, the way I've said that? but
accurate,
it isn't.
Though.
Yes, but it is a Christmas cancer tragicomedy. Yeah. Okay, so shall we get started then? Because we've got a lot to get through there. It's time to get on the farm with this. So that's Lamb, the directorial debut from Valdimar Johansson, following a sheep farming couple in Iceland who discover one of their flock has given birth to a half-human, half-ovine creature and decide to parent it. Noomi Rapace, who spent her childhood on a farm in Iceland, stars as a woman who finds solace from grief in mothering a changeling. Before we get on to that, let's listen to what Noomi had to say when I sat down with her earlier this week to discuss the film.
Let's talk about your new film, Lamb, which is incredible. And it's a film with very, very few words. It's very much more about the visuals and the tone. So I'm interested in how the writer-director explained his vision to you for this, like how he conveyed what this was going to look like for you.
Basically, he came to London with his wife, who's the producer of the film, and they came to my house with a package of the script, his mood board, which is like pictures and drawings and images that he's been collecting for over like 14 years or something, and then a book of poems from Sean, the writer. So he gave me this strange package, and then he went outside for a cigarette and just left me with this, and I was like, okay, now what? Like, I'm so used to directors kind of pitching stuff and like trying to hook you and, you know, pull you in and convince you. And he just left me with this. And I started looking at all these images, and I've read the script before, but then I was like, I didn't know at all what he kind of what he had in mind. And then the more I got like into his, you know, it's quite thick, this book of really strange and disturbing and twisted images, I was like, oh, it just felt like I was pulled in and like kind of seduced, and I got lost and found in his universe, and I just knew straight away that I had to do this. It just felt like my whole being has been waiting for this, for this specific project, for Maria, and for this film that brought me back to my roots, to Iceland, where I grew up, where I did my first film when I was 7. And, you know, so it's like on many levels, just like tapped in and hooked into to me. So it has a very special place in me and my life.
You mentioned, obviously, that you spent your childhood in Iceland. So did you feel like you really knew Maria? You knew who this woman was, and the sort of battle that she's living with in terms of not only she's got psychological issues from things that have happened, but also she's living in this place that's very timeless. It's light, there's the sheep farming, the same thing happens all the time. Mm. She's sort of living in this this strange otherworldly place. Did you feel like you really knew who that woman was?
It was almost like she found me rather than me looking for her. And I had this image that, you know, I'm in a vehicle and she's driving and I'm sitting next to her. I just hope that she will take care of me and that she will drop me off in a safe place when we're done, you know, in the end of this adventure. I did grow up on a farm, but Maria, I think the environment around her also kind of reflects her inner space, that she's almost caught and stuck in this limbo reality of pain and grief because she lost a child. And, you know, how do you come back from that? Like, how do you start functioning again? And like, you know, and in the beginning of the film, she can't allow herself to feel. And this film is very much about healing and mending and finding a way back to life and to motherhood, to be a mother again.
It's lovely then when, you know, one character says, you know, what is that? And it's just happiness. This is happiness that this this child represents for this family. Tell me about sort of preparing for this. I mean, you obviously grew up on a farm, so you're aware of, you know, a lot of it. But lambing, I'm assuming you haven't done before?
No. That part was new. And it was my first day on set. I came, you know, I was super jet lagged. I finished a film on a Friday in New Orleans and I flew to Iceland and drove like 6 hours up to the north of Iceland, got in like Sunday afternoon, and Monday morning I'm basically pulling out a lamb from a sheep. I'd spoke to Valdemar maybe for a year before, like on and off, and I came to Iceland twice and we went to some farmers. But it was a very internal preparation. I had to just kind of things away and peel layers of distractions off me. And it's probably one of the most honest and most kind of raw and intimate films I've done. You know, it was like, no, because there's very little dialogues, you know, it's like you can't really hide behind anything. It's like you are there with the animals and it's like the camera, you never really knew when the camera's on you. It's like a 360, just fully alive and living it all the time. And I felt like I've been craving this. I love art house films. I've been like dying to go back into that space and to that field of filmmaking. And that's where I started. And this was a great opportunity for me to reconnect with that side of me. And Maria just found me, sort of.
Tell me about Ada and working with, well, a lamb sometimes, a puppet sometimes, CGI sometimes. What was that process like? And were you anxious about getting this right? Because it's very difficult to get this, you know.
Could have been awful. Could have been a disaster. Yeah. I mean, imagine the call when I called my team and said, I'm doing this film. And it's about like a farm, a couple in north of Iceland, and it's like no budget at all, first time director. And, you know, I'm the mother of a half sheep, half lamb, half human. It's like, sounds like a horrible idea. So obviously there was like this fear, like that it would turn out to be not believable. I mean, I worked with real lambs and real babies. It was like not really green screen at all. And it was just a few times a puppet. So I was working with babies that were reacting to me and most of the times not doing what I want them to do. and lambs as well, you know, and they live their own life. So I had to find a way to be very playful and not, you couldn't really plan anything. You just had to go with whatever happened and be open and communication starts to happen on a different level. And it's, you know, I remember this one scene when I'm out on the field with Ada and put the flower crown on her. Mm. And she just, all of a sudden, she became really still and she put her face really close to my face. And she just started breathing with me. And it was this magical moment of, it felt like we were talking to each other. And I felt like I knew what she was thinking. And she was, and Valdemar didn't say cut. It was just rolling. It felt like it went on for like maybe 3-4 minutes. And after that, I had like tears in my eyes and was like, wow, we spoke to each other. You know, it's just a different way of communication. And after this film, I came out like back into the real world. And I was like, wow, people talk too much. Yeah. It's too many words for me. Can we just slow down?
Yeah. Did it make you want to get a baby sheep?
I did grow up with, like, we did have bottle lambs, you know, the ones that you feed because the mother doesn't want them. So that was a part of my childhood and don't really want to go back to anything in my childhood. So no, done that.
I was also just really interested in the sort of mythology of this and the changeling mythology that's hugely important in sort of Icelandic sort of culture and folklore. Do you think that this is something that we've seen quite a lot of it in other films as well? Why do you think we're so interested in this idea of hybrid creatures and creatures that are otherworldly? And why is this, the idea of a lamb human, such an enticing and interesting idea?
I mean, when I was pregnant with my son, I had a strange, as weird, as the most disturbing dreams. I dreamt that I gave birth to kittens, to rabbits, to, you know, half human, half like something, like a human with like fur. And it's just, I think it's something deeply rooted in us. I mean, that's the biggest fear, isn't it? To give birth to something and you've been pregnant for 9 months and then something that is not a human comes out. I mean, in Iceland, we do live very close to the nature. And when I first moved there, when I was five, I remember my grandmother, my Icelandic grandmother, saying to me, you know, it was like Christmas time. And she was like, if you, you know, if you're not a good girl, if you're not nice, you know, the Christmas cat will come and take you and eat you. And I was like, wow. You know, what do you mean the Christmas cat? And then it was like, and we have 13 Santa Clauses then, and they're all evil. They're all really bad. And they are the sons of Grýla, which is a Icelandic witch who also eat kids. So it's like around Christmas, all these like terrible threats that's hanging over. So, you know, I think there's like this kind of dark shadow overshining a lot of holidays in Iceland. You know, elves and creatures and fairies are a part of everyday life in Iceland in a very different way. And I remember when my grandmother was, you know, we were out riding. I loved horses. I was obsessed with riding. I was always out with her as often as I could. And we were crossing a river. The water was really like up to my knees and the horse like had to swim a bit. And I was looking down and it was quite like, you know, kind of strong, kind of pulling us. And I remember that my grandmother kept saying, don't look down in the water because the water elves will call your name and you might want to join them and you won't come back, you know. So it was, that was like those elements, the nature elements and the creature we can't see, but they're always there. That was something that I was introduced to as something very normal. It's just, you can't see them, but they're here, you know. Mm-hmm. So I do think that Icelandic people do live with that in mind and a kind of accepted things we can't see, but they are there.
So this is Lam. I sort of set it up at the top there, Jordan, but do you want to just give us a little more detail about what happens in this film?
Numira Pastar, she plays Maria. She lives on a very remote farm with her husband, Ingvar. At the start of the film, they're kind of going through the motions a bit. It's clear that they've been doing this for a long time. They know what they're doing. And then suddenly one day a sheep gives birth, as a sheep has done many times on this farm before. But there's something unusual about this baby, this lamb, because the child is a half human. And what I really admired about this film was its sort of commitment to show, don't tell. Never felt like it was over-explaining what it was doing. So little of what's going on is explained in any way at all, really. You really have to watch very closely how people react. A lot of the story is told through body language and microfacial expressions rather than dialogue. Mm. You get the sense that either this couple has lost a child before and this has driven them to accept this child more easily than they perhaps would have done, or that this has possibly happened before, that a kind of half human, half animal
hybrid.
Oh,
did you think that? Oh, yeah, that's interesting.
I think there's a lot of ways you can read this, yeah. And that was sort of my impression, that either they're sort of aware this could happen because they're not really that surprised. They're not horrified by
it. Yeah, and they don't discuss it. They don't like run around the barn going like, what the hell is that? They're just, oh, that's arrived.
Yeah, exactly. And they're very willing to accept her. And they just treat her like a daughter, like a human daughter, like they would with their own child. And for all intents and purposes, Arda is their child. There's this very just horribly tragic element where the sheep who gives birth to Arda kind of pines for her daughter and walks up to the window and starts bleating and crying at night. And you just feel so sad for this poor sheep. And something very sad happens to this sheep, which ties into the idea of protecting one's child and what lengths Maria will go to do that. So I thought it was a really fascinating film on that level, in the sense that it is one that really doesn't try to over-explain what's going on. It really leaves you to kind of interpret it and understand it in your own way.
Mm. Matthew, did you enjoy it? Did you like it?
Yeah, I don't know if I enjoyed it. I mean, it's certainly very compelling and strange and unpredictable. And yeah, and I thought the performances were terrific. But I think there was something in it that I didn't quite engage with. I can't really put my finger on what it was.
It's very other, isn't it?
Yeah.
And designed that way, intentionally so.
Yeah, you feel like with a few changes, this could be set on like Mars or in like a few centuries ago. Like Iceland is such an alien landscape as it is.
And it's used often as alien landscapes.
Exactly.
They often film there, don't they? And it's also got this weird timelessness, doesn't it? That they're not like WhatsApping people. They have a VHS player in their house. They watch a football game, but you're not sure if they're even watching that in like real time or on a loop.
Just a recording.
There's no outside world here. It's very sort of oppressive, and the mists just blow in. And even this is in summer, isn't it, in Iceland? Because they have the light all the year round. So they're going to sleep in the middle of the day. And that in itself is just very discombobulating to see people finish their day and it's still completely daylight and they just go to sleep and then they wake up and it's the same. It's all very unsettling and odd. Mm. But, you know, what Noomi was saying about this idea of in Iceland it being entirely normal to live your life alongside the reality of sprites and elves and trolls and monsters that live in nature and are part of the world. That really is successfully done here, I think. The fact that this other that happens, no spoilers, but is just a part of life and is just part of the natural landscape of Iceland. And it could have gone terribly wrong, this, couldn't it? I mean, you know, a half child, half sheep thing that I think they sort of managed to do with a combination of a real sheep, a real baby, a little bit of CGI and some puppetry. It's actually, you totally accept it, don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
And the sheep's a great actress, the little lamb sheep, little Ada.
Yeah, it's stunningly well achieved, actually, because I can't imagine they had a huge budget to make this film, but I was completely convinced by Ada throughout the entire thing. Yeah, they did an exceptional job with her. Mm. I think they're keeping some of their tricks up their sleeves. They're not quite revealing exactly how they've done it, but I think whatever they've done, they've pulled it off incredibly well.
Yeah, and obviously this is a first-time director that Noomi put her sort of faith in, and she exec produced this film because she thought it was so interesting. Do you think it shows great promise for what he can do next?
Oh yeah, I can't wait to see where he goes next. I mean, I don't know how much stranger he can go, but certainly I think he's showing a lot of promise there and a lot of imagination. And even though you can kind of compare it to a few other things, it does feel like a very original piece of work. I've seen comparisons with Stuart Little.
Stuart Little?
Yes. As in, you know, they kind of have a mouse son. And yes. There's no kind of question.
Yes, he just is a mouse in a tiny car. You know, I also think that there's a great deal of sort of sadness in this as well. You mentioned, Jordan, that there's this history that we don't specifically hear about. We just have to fill in the blanks of what might have happened. But just the sadness of the fact that they have this cot in the barn, gathering dust that's ready. They have these tiny clothes available for Ada to wear. There is the suggestion of this tragedy that's happened and this need and this yearning, and that perhaps she came to them because of a need in their lives. And you know that they don't speak pretty much in the first half of the film, but then as this child comes to them, they open up, they're playful, they chat, they have sex, you know, all sorts of things come back to life. So it is a really interesting psychological study as well as a sort of gothic horror. Would you call it a horror?
Yeah, definitely a horror. I'd definitely call it a horror, yeah. It's more on the psychological side than the kind of jump scary side. There is one other significant character in the film, which is the brother of Ingvar, who kind of comes into the film around the halfway mark. And he's really there to sort of throw a cat amongst the pigeons and cause a little bit of trouble. And we sort of learn that Maria and this brother character have a bit of history as well. And it's really interesting waiting to see how he's going to react to Ada. I won't say precisely what his reaction is, but I actually found the introduction of that character quite interesting as well, because he's almost like the viewer's perspective on what it would be like to just turn up in this situation and discover
there's a sheep child in the kitchen in wellies.
Exactly, but I thought it was actually incredibly smart what they did with that character as well, because you expect it to go one direction and it actually swerves off in another and wrong foots you a little bit in quite an interesting way and sets up the ending incredibly well, I thought.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so I think we can say that we'd recommend that people go and see this on the big screen. I mean, it's beautifully filmed.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's hard to get Iceland wrong, really, isn't it? You just point a camera and you have something amazing looking.
Yes, dramatic scenery everywhere. And the dramatic scenery of Noomi Rapace's cheekbones.
Always a spectacle unto themselves.
Yes. Exactly. I mean, a word for her as well, because I don't think she's had the best roles in recent years. Certainly, you know, since The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and maybe Prometheus, I don't think I've really seen her in anything where she's absolutely blown me away. But I thought this was, Noomi at her best in a long time, actually.
Yeah, I mean, she has to do a lot with no dialogue, really, and her expressiveness is insane.
In Icelandic as well.
And in Icelandic. Yeah. But the woman speaks 5 languages fluently. I mean, she's incredible. She, wow. Yeah, so well done, Noomi, from somebody who speaks 1 and a bit. So, yes, it is an incredible performance from her.
I can barely speak 1 language. So.
Certainly not Icelandic. So well done, Noomi. Okay, so that is Lamb, and that is at cinemas from this Friday. And if you'd like to hear more from Noomi and what 4 films she'd program at the cinema on her last day on Earth, check out our new sister podcast, Total Film's Last Picture Show, which is out on all podcast platforms tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear what Noomi picks.
One of the films I was like, oh, I can see the connection to this. And she picked some very interesting films and she was very eloquent about them. So
is it Shaun the Sheep? Is that one?
There was a sheep connection, but it wasn't Shaun the Sheep.
Babe Pig in the City.
Nope. And it wasn't Stuart Little. Okay, shall we move on then? It's time to watch a musical charting the gang warfare between Empire and Total Film. No, I'm just kidding.
What?
It is gang warfare. It's this.
I never seen you before. You're not Puerto Rican.
Is that okay?
Do you want to start World War III?
You know, I wake up to everything I know either getting sold or wrecked or being taken over by people that I don't like.
You keep away from him as long as you're in my house.
I'm a grown up now, Bernardo. I'm gonna think for myself.
Tony. We need you if we're going to war.
Who are you?
Friend or foe?
So this is West Side Story, Steven Spielberg's version of the classic. Matthew, tell us about it. For those that have never seen the original, what's it about?
Well, I mean, it originated as a musical, Broadway musical in the 50s, and then became a massive Oscar-winning hit in 1961, won 11 Oscars, including Best Picture. And now Steven Spielberg has made his own version, which is very similar to the old version. So it's still set in the 50s. It's still about this rivalry between these two gangs, the Jets and the Sharks. And it's still about this star-crossed romance between Tony, who's a Jet, and Maria, who's on the Sharks' side. We should all say it's all based on Romeo and Juliet. It's basically Romeo and Juliet with more knives and denim. Yeah, and songs, yeah.
You said it's quite similar. It's very similar, isn't it?
It's very similar. It's super similar.
Is there any point to it?
It's incredibly slick. There's some amazing camera moves, incredible visuals. The cast is incredibly well chosen. They really look like they're of the period. There's lots of flourish. It keeps the original music, the original songs and choreography. But yeah, if you do know the original quite well, if you've seen that recently or even not so recently, you might find this is just a bit of a carbon copy, and you might expect a little bit more from Spielberg, really. I mean, he does update it in a few crucial ways. Because the original was a little bit problematic in terms of its casting and its take on race, and he's kind of been mindful of that and tweaked it accordingly. Certainly, I kind of expected that he might have pushed it a bit further. It's very reverential.
Yes, I mean, Spielberg said he's done it for his father. Yes. It's a film that he and his father really loved. Mm. And so this is a sort of love letter to his father in a way. Yeah, he's obviously incredibly in love with the original.
Yeah.
Jordan, did you like it? Are you a musicals guy? I mean, if you even like musicals, is this for anybody who, you know, isn't into the musical?
Yeah, I like a good musical. I wouldn't say I was like a theatre kid or anything. I'm not on tenterhooks waiting for every musical that comes out. And I've seen the original. I like the original. I don't have a huge connection to the original, I have to admit. So caveat all my future thoughts with that in mind. But I'm sort of on the same wavelength as you two, to be honest. Like, I wasn't entirely sure what the point of the exercise was. Just setting it in the same time period, exactly the same songs, exactly the same lyrics, pretty much the same choreography, just everything identical apart from a few kind of key updates, as Matthew mentioned. I just wondered why he would want to spend like a few years of his life on this, you know?
Yeah.
It was just a very, very odd experience. But on the one hand, I can understand why you would want to introduce this story and this music and these incredible lyrics by Stephen Sondheim to a new audience. you know, people are arguably more receptive to musicals right now than they ever have been.
Yeah, we're on a run with them, aren't we?
Exactly, especially on the big screen. But then you've had things like Hamilton, which were just a phenomenal success on the stage. So it feels like there is an audience there for a film like this. I just wonder if it'll just feel too old-fashioned for some people. It's just a very traditional musical made in a very traditional way, whereas, you know, if you've watched things like Hamilton and In the Heights, you'll know that there are more modern ways of doing stories like this now. And to me, a 2.5 hour, very trad musical just might not set audiences on ablaze like they're kind of hoping, I think. I mean, that said, Spielberg, you know, he's on his A game here in terms of, you know, blocking shots and his camera movements and all that kind of stuff. Like, it looks absolutely stunning. Like, I don't know what film stock or color grading they did to this, but it looks like it was shot in like the 50s. You know, it looks absolutely incredible. Like, I loved the way it looked, and I thought they did an incredible job for the most part casting it. Some of the faces in this film look like, you know, they've been
central casting 1955.
Exactly.
Don't they?
It looks like they hopped in a DeLorean and just like picked these people up from from the time period and brought them to the present day. It's amazing some of the faces they've got in here. I really loved Ariana DeBose, who I thought was the MVP of this film. You know, she gets arguably the best song in the film, America, which is just shot with like such vibrancy and such verve. That whole sequence is incredible, and she's terrific in it. But I do have a major casting issue, which maybe we can move on
it's
to.
It's probably the same one as mine. Is it Ansel?
Yeah, Ansel. Unfortunately, he didn't do it for me at all.
No, me neither.
Partly because he just didn't fit. He doesn't have that period authentic face. He almost looks too modern. He moves in a modern way. So that put me off immediately. I didn't think he was that great a dancer or a singer either, which is a bit of a problem when you're playing Tony in West Side Story, you know. Like, he was constantly like fumbling, and, you know, I've got two left feet, so I can't really speak, but I sort of expect a higher standard you know, on-screen musicals. And he really badly messes up like a few key emotional beats as well, to the point where it just undercuts what you're meant to be feeling in those scenes.
Yeah.
Which is a real shame, because everyone around him, for the most part, I really, really liked. I liked Rachel Zegler as Maria.
Loved who was found online.
Yeah, incredible. And she does such a wonderful job. Like, imagine being in a
Spielberg. I know, it's like, hey, Rachel, you're online. Would you like to come and be in a Steven Spielberg film with all of these other, you know, actors who have, you know, been doing it for years and everything? I mean, she does an incredible job for somebody that's literally walked into that. I mean,
she's
amazing.
Quite natural, isn't she?
Yes. Yeah. But as you say, Ariana DeBose really steals it as Anita, which is quite the feat when the real Anita, the original Anita,
is right there.
Standing there. You know, Rita Moreno is the exec producer on this, and she also takes on the role of Doc, in as much as she's playing Doc's wife. Doc in the original was obviously the kindly local man who was a sort of father figure to Tony. She is now Doc's wife. And gets a key song that was a bit unexpected. Mm. It's lovely to see her in it, but, you know, the spectre, as you say, of the original cast and the original staging and the dancing and even the costumes hangs over this. Mm. And you can see the shadow, the ghosts of that when you're watching it. And Ariana DeBose is the only one that actually, I totally forgot the original Anita when I was watching her. I felt she was it. And I'd be very surprised if she doesn't get some award nods, because I think she's incredible in this. But yeah, I agree with you too. It's incredibly classy. It feels like a beautiful box of chocolates, you know, a really high-end box of chocolates that's been wrapped wonderfully. But then when you open it, they're all caramel and there's no range. It's just, it's exactly the same. And I know you said that, you know, Spielberg's tried to update with the race issues, sort of tried to talk about a rape incident and also, you know, toxic masculinity within certain areas. But then you think, well, if you're going to do that, why didn't you just go a whole hog? And right. And the update that I sort of think about always as being an absolute cracker is Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah,
and when I think about Romeo and Juliet, we all know what it is. We know what it's going to be. But that took it and made it completely fresh, completely new, urgent, desperately romantic. And you felt you had not seen Romeo and Juliet before as portrayed here. And I wanted that for West Side Story, but actually I didn't feel swept away by the romance or the sad things that happen in it. I was just like, that's happened now.
That was a letdown from Spielberg as well, because you think he's the one who can always hit your emotional buttons. So
I mean, I cry every time at E.T., and yet I didn't manage to shed a tear in this at all. So something wasn't firing for me either. However, having said that, it's coming out at Christmas. Is it the sort of movie that's, you know, take the whole family, you know, your grandma's going to enjoy this? Is it sort of a family outing thing that is a Christmas movie? Do you think it will do well?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure if you take the family along, you'll probably have a good time. Bear in mind, it's 2.5 hours long, so it's not...
With no intermission, unlike the original, which had an intermission.
Yes.
So yeah, it's not a breezy watch. And it's probably also worth mentioning that they've done a quite interesting thing with the spoken Spanish in this film as well, because it's unsubtitled. And I would probably estimate about a quarter of the spoken dialogue in this film is in Spanish, unsubtitled. Which was done so that English wasn't given precedence over Spanish, but does mean that you're inferring what is going on from the way people are saying things and the context of the scene a lot of the time. So you do have to sort of pay attention and make sure you're...
And that could be frustrating for some people.
Exactly. If you're taking your like 60-year-old granny along, maybe 70-year-old granny.
My grandma would be like, what? What are they saying? It could be a tricky one. Okay, so that is West Side Story and is out in cinemas on the big screen, looking glorious, tomorrow.
I like to be in America. Okay, by me in America. Everything free in America.
For a small fee in America.
Okay, it's time for a TV history lesson from Aaron Sorkin. It's this.
Lucille Ball's a threat to the American way of life?
Does the FBI have any case against Lucy?
I need you to help me save my marriage.
How many times I gotta explain where I was and what I was doing?
You gotta explain.
Are you being funny right now?
I'm Lucille Ball. When I'm being funny, you'll know.
This is getting out of hand.
Madness.
Have you been cheating on me?
The story's made up.
If they boo me?
If they boo you, we're done.
Okay, so this is Being the Ricardos, the story of a sort of week in the life of Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz whilst they were making their show, I Love Lucy, during all sorts of catastrophes. Jordan, what's going on in their lives when we meet them?
As you say, it's set primarily over the course of this single fraught week for Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, because there are these accusations in the newspaper, first that Desi is cheating on Lucille, and secondly, that Lucille was once a member of the Communist Party, which is obviously a big concern at the time of McCarthyism and the House of Un-American Activities Commission, all that kind of stuff. So it tracks both the making of an episode over the course of a week, from sort of the table read, which is a very testy table read, I have to say, through rehearsals to eventually the sort of recording in front of a live studio audience. Meanwhile, there's all this behind the scenes drama going on with the writers and the producers and everything that's going on in Lucille and Desi Arnaz's personal lives. And at the same time as well, you have all these flashbacks to how Lucille and Desi met and how they fell in love. It's a slightly more ambitious script than I was expecting going in, but I probably should have expected that given that it's Aaron Sorkin.
Yes.
And he is a bit of an accomplished writer. For some reason I had in my head this was just going to be one week, a bit like Steve Jobs, you know, like it was just going to be very focused, but it's a bit more expansive and ambitious than that. But I have to say I did struggle with this one a bit. Part of the problem for me is that I've never seen a single second of I Love Lucy.
I don't know how that's possible.
I mean, I grew up in the 80s and 90s in the UK, so...
I mean, it is quite incredible that, you know, I mean, one of the things that they do discuss in this is her incredible sort of... She reached millions of homes. People didn't use the water during the time this show was on. Huge cultural impact. And it does crop up in other films. That's why I'm marvelling, because I think my knowledge of I Love Lucy is probably through other people on films watching I Love Lucy.
Yeah, I don't know. Did it ever air in the UK? It probably did. Like,
it's probably on BBC Two on graveyard shift at some point.
Yeah, you know, the most I know about I Love Lucy is it's a bit like WandaVision.
That's
the most I know.
That's our reference point.
Exactly. And I don't know a huge about Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz either, which is, you know, that's on me. But the fact remains that because I didn't have this sort of baseline of knowledge, I felt like I was a little bit on the outside looking in, and I wasn't entirely sure what they were talking about a lot of the time. Like, there seems to be a lot of assumed knowledge about what happens in this one specific episode of I Love Lucy. Yeah. I don't know if it's a particular iconic episode.
It's the Stomping
episode.
Grapes one, and it is iconic. Yeah, yeah. It's sure the one that I'm aware of. Yeah.
I'm sure it is, but I just felt the whole time that like I was sort of left out in the cold a little bit. Again, my fault. Like, I don't know these people or this show all that well, but there were elements I liked. I thought Nicole Kidman and Javier Bardem, for the most part, were good. I don't know if they're good representations of those people because I don't know them all, but I enjoyed their performances. I thought they were really committed, especially Nicole Kidman, because she's been given this kind of surreal makeover and she looks very odd. And I'm not quite sure what they've done to her, if it's just makeup or it's prosthetics.
I couldn't work that out as well. It's like,
she seems to have very beady eyes, doesn't she? Like, I don't know how you
like, there's an eyebrow thing that's doing something, but there also seems to be some prosthetics that are changing the shape of her face in a way. It's disquieting.
So that was a little unsettling, but I did enjoy, you know, Javier Bardem like belting out a few songs and...
Yeah.
Playing various instruments and stuff.
And doing his Scarface accent. Because, I mean, there has been controversy, you guys, on his casting, that he is a Spanish man, not a Cuban man, which is what Desi was. So he's doing a Cuban accent, which is a little strange. For me, it felt a bit like Al Pacino doing the look at them pelicans fly. You know, like just what, I don't know, it felt weird to me. And I can see the issue. Obviously, there are Cuban actors out there who could have played this role. And equally, there was a lot of hoo-ha when Nicole Kidman was cast that wouldn't Deborah Messing have been a better fit for it? Because Nicole doesn't look anything like her. Did she work for you, Matthew? Did she convince? And have you seen I Love Lucy? Did you know what you were going into here?
Yeah, I don't think I've ever actually seen an episode. Mm. But yeah, I'm kind of aware of it. Just through references to other things. Isn't it in Back to the Future?
Yeah.
Yeah, so things like that. But yeah, I did find her look a little bit distracting, a bit like when she played Virginia Woolf in The Hours.
With the nose.
Yeah, it seemed a bit unnecessary.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Destroyer as well, where she looks like she's been dragged through gravel or something.
Yeah. She does like a makeover, doesn't she?
Yeah, but that does get you awards buzz, and there is sort of beginning now awards buzz around Nicole's performance. Yeah. Do we think she will be in the final five or six?
I reckon not. I think certainly on the long list, but I think it'll fall by the wayside.
We need to see how the field shakes out and see if she's got a shot.
She's not going to beat Spencer, is she?
What did you think as well about this? Obviously, this is very much about Lucy and Desi, but equally it's very much a love letter from Sorkin to the process of comedy and the writer's room. It's very much an inside baseball look at the production and manufacture of a script, which obviously, as we know from his past, he's done a lot and is an expert in. Did you find that a bit smug and sort of, you know, self-regarding? Like, look at these writers, look how amazing they are, look. And also the fact that there's a lot of anachronistic stuff said in this. You know, people say gaslighting, they talk about, I'm the showrunner. I don't think anyone called themselves a showrunner in the 50s, but I stand to be corrected. But yeah, and people talk in a very modern way, and that classic Sorkin, you know, quick, witty, always got a good line for each other.
Very Sorkin.
Was that something that you think is entertaining? Because I found it grating personally.
I have to say I did enjoy that element sort of slightly more than the character stuff, if I'm honest. Like, I did find it kind of interesting just tracking the production of an episode. Like, I thought that was something I hadn't quite seen in a film before, and it felt interesting that it was Aaron Sorkin, who of course made one of the great TV shows in the West Wing, who was doing this. So it's obviously coming from a point of authority almost. I was wondering how much of this was historical record, and how much was fabricated.
I mean, I think basically what I was reading was that he's really taken liberties, because the other thing is this bookend, this strange bookend, that it has this faux documentary at the beginning with the writers older now talking about their younger selves, which we then see, but they're not even the writers either. So,
well, yeah, they're actors.
They're actors as well.
One of them's Ronnie Cox from RoboCop.
Exactly.
So that was a bit of a giveaway. Yeah.
So it's just like, it's sort of playing with the artifice of it from the get-go, isn't it? But then also, all of these things happened, but not in the 1 week. So there's artistic license going on there. So you do have to look at it as a confection that he's trying to find the truths within.
I totally get that. Like, he's at liberty to do that as a writer. What I did find interesting was the way it locates this story within what was going on in America at the time with McCarthyism. It doesn't feel like a huge part of the film, because the story just zeroes in and on Lucille and Desi like so closely. You don't get a sense of the bigger picture, like what the public reaction to this news is.
Mm.
You just get a sense that these people believe if this comes out any further, then the show's over. But I'm not really sure that I felt those stakes entirely. They constantly refer to the fact that Lucille's just been interviewed by the FBI, which is something you never see, and you never get a real sense of what that meeting was like. Like, was it quite intense, or were they just like, yeah, you're clearly not a communist, go on with your day. And it ends with something which I almost couldn't believe was real, and I'm not sure if it is real or not, which is a sort of phone call, which I won't sort of spoil because it kind of comes near the end. But yeah, all that stuff just prompted me to want to read about it and kind of learn about that aspect of it. So in that regard, it was
It's successful. Intrigued you.
Yeah, exactly.
It's intrigued you, Matthew. You're going to be reading a Lucy biography.
I had read about this whole incident before, actually. I'd read a thing about, McCarthyism in general and about her this week. So I'd be intrigued to see how it dramatises all that.
And also their children, who were in the film as a toddler and inside Lucy, she's pregnant at this point, both exec produced this as well, which is interesting to know that they were happy with this portrayal of their parents.
Yeah, because it doesn't feel sanitized, but it portrays unsavory things that happened in their relationship, I will say. And it doesn't try to skirt around those, which, you know, is commendable given that the children, the family were involved.
Okay, so I think we're saying it's intriguing, if not quite setting us alight.
Yeah, I much preferred Chicago 7 last year, if we're talking recent Aaron Sorkin films. Like, I thought that just had a lot more urgency and kind of vigor to it, whereas this, I don't know, just felt a little bit flat to me. And that just might be because of what I was bringing to it as someone who didn't care all that much about I Love Lucy.
There you go.
Do you like it more than Bewitched with Nicole Kidman and Will
yes.
Ferrell?
Of course, of course. That is Being the Ricardos, which is actually out in cinemas on Friday. But then if you don't get to see it at the big screen, it's available on Amazon Prime from the 21st of December. Right, it's time for Plain Talking now, where we demystify things that are said on film sets. This week, it's B-roll. What's a B-roll, Matthew?
It's to do with catering. The stars get the selection of the best food.
Are you serious?
And then the ones that are left over, that's the B-rolls. So, you know, they might be gone off a bit or not the best quality. Is that not right?
They go to the grips.
It kind of goes down.
Okay, so the
journalists at the
bottom. The terrible rolls from catering. That is not what it is it, Jordan?
Oh, what? I'm confused
Matthew.
Now. It's the footage, which isn't kind of the main unit footage. It's what you'll use for cutaways and various other elements. For example, if someone's starting a car, you might have a bit of B-roll footage of someone turning the key, which you can use in an insert. It's kind of the little bits that you need to establish continuity in a scene, but aren't necessarily actors giving performances to camera, if that makes sense.
Yep. Perfect. So that is what a B-roll is. Okay, shall we move on? It's time for a little festive Armageddon now.
I hear there's something you don't like the looks of.
We discovered a very large comet.
Oh, good for you.
It's headed directly towards Earth.
This comet is what we call a planet killer.
At this exact moment, I say we sit tight and assess.
Sit tight and assess?
Sit tight.
And then assess. The sit tight part comes first, then you gotta digest it. That's the assessment period.
This is the worst news in the history of humanity. He just blew us off.
What are we gonna do? We have to release the information.
So we just leak it.
Okay, so this is Adam McKay's Don't Look Up with, I mean, everybody's in it. Kate Blanchett, there's Jennifer Lawrence, there's Leonardo DiCaprio, Jonah Hill.
Timothy Chalamet, Meryl Streep.
I almost forgot Meryl Streep. That's how many people are in this. Matthew, what are all these people doing?
There's a weird thing with disaster movies where they come in pairs. So you had like Deep Impact and Armageddon. And then back in the day, you had Doctor Strangelove and Failsafe. And one's kind of more serious than the other. And so this is kind of like the inversion of last year's Greenland, which is a very serious, or kind of, for a Gerard Butler film, quite a serious take on a comet heading towards Earth. Whereas this is the same principle, but done in a much more satirical kind of way. It starts off with the two astronomers who discover this comet, played by Jennifer Lawrence and Leonardo DiCaprio. And they take this evidence straight to the president, and they give her this briefing, But then she kind of basically uses this information to be very opportunistic about it.
Shocker.
To her advantage. Yeah, I know. I mean,
that would happen in politics.
Yeah, as if, you know, to make see if they can make as much money as possible out of it and score, you know, points from it. And that's how it kind of proceeds while this comet is getting ever closer and we're getting nearer to doomsday.
Yeah. There's obviously Cate Blanchett as a very toothy TV presenter. And then we also have Timothy Chalamet as like a
skater dude who's like,
yeah,
called Yule, which
a guy called Yule who lives behind,
is that a real name,
behind a supermarket skating and drinking
and streaming.
Did it work for you, Jordan?
I have to say it did, actually. I've always enjoyed Adam McKay's films, you know, going back to Anchorman and Step Brothers, which were his more kind of anarchic comedies before he made films like The Big Short and Vice, which were obviously a bit more dramatic and a bit more satirical. And for me, this felt like almost the perfect middle ground between those two styles. It's a little bit dafter, a little bit sillier, but it still has that really biting satirical edge to it. Its sort of primary target is climate change and specifically human inaction to combat climate change. That feels like the thing that really got him fired up initially. But really, sort of everything that's wrong with modern society is in his is in his crosshairs here. You have like big tech, like the 24-hour news cycle, celebrity culture, meme culture, capitalism, partisan politics, sort of the breakdown of civil discourse, suspicion of science, organized religion, like all this stuff is like a target for him in this film. The sort of takedown of America at large and Western culture, I just found it just an extremely funny sort of snapshot of the situation that we find ourselves in today.
It totally reflects reality. It's not far-fetched what's going on here. You could well believe the things that happen in this film would happen. Did you enjoy 100%. It, Matthew?
Yeah, I did, hugely, yeah. But yeah, I mean, at the same time, because like Jordan says, because it piles it on so much, I was kind of on the verge of despair quite a few times because it is so close to reality and it is all these things kind of crushing in at once. But it is, yeah, it's incredibly funny and the performances are terrific. I mean, it's a really long film, but I think it does kind of justify its length, really, because it kind of services all the characters really well.
And this is, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio doing funny, which I don't think we've seen him do a role like this before at all. And he is actually really very amusing in it. Did you enjoy him above anyone else? I mean, this is a stuffed cast. Who was your sort of your MVP of such cracking actors?
Yeah, it's hard to pick. Yeah, I mean, I kind of put him and Jennifer Lawrence on a par, really. I thought they were both great and a terrific comic timing. But yeah, I thought everyone was terrific. I mean, Ron Perlman has quite a small but significant role in it, and he really sells that brilliantly. Mark Rylance, who plays a very similar character to the one he did in Ready Player One.
Yes,
he seems
very
to
much
have
so.
Carried over
yeah.
his
but with more
intonation.
Teeth.
A lot creepier.
Yeah.
Just clearly values like money over human life, which gives him quite a sinister edge. Yeah.
Yeah,
Rylance was the one performance that didn't entirely work for me, I have to be honest. I just found him a little unsettling, which probably was the purpose, but I'd actually seen The Phantom of the Open the same week that I saw this, and he's so funny in that film, like genuinely one of the top five like comedic performances that I've seen in the last decade. And I couldn't help but be slightly let down by what he does in this film.
Yeah.
But I actually absolutely love Jonah Hill in this.
Yeah, he's great.
You know, many of his jokes are ad libs, apparently.
Oh, okay.
Right.
So, you know, he does a prayer when the world's about to go to hell. To apartments and really cool stuff that's in apartments.
Yeah,
which
he's just
that sort of thing that he made up on the fly.
He's just this materialistic, this douchebag. He's the son of the president, so he's got
he's
everything.
The chief of staff.
He's the chief of staff, so he's got everything on a silver platter, and he's still like just a complete jerk to everyone for just no reason. A very annoying person, but very funny to watch on screen.
Yeah. I also really enjoyed Jennifer Lawrence in this. We haven't seen her for a while. She's had a sort of self-imposed time away to sort of regroup. And she's come back with this. And I really enjoy her being funny.
Yeah.
And I loved, there's this whole joke about snacks in the White House.
That's great. Oh, yeah,
that I felt like Adam McKay had written her character really, really well. Because that is exactly what I would do. That in the midst of this horror that, you know, we are all going to get killed from a meteor, you would fixate for days that somebody had given you free snacks and charged you for them. And you'd be furious about it for days. So the fact that she kept harping on about this, I found very, very amusing. The sort of bum note for me was Timothy Chalamet. I didn't really know what the point of him was as a character. I mean, he did fine with it, but he sort of shoved in there and didn't really add very much to proceedings.
Quite liked him.
Did you?
Yeah.
Did you like him?
He carried some emotional weight.
Liked
as
his
he went
mullet.
On. Yeah, I thought he looked pretty cool. And yeah, by the end, I thought he was kind of carrying some more emotional weight of the film.
Yeah, and I also love the fact that Melanie Lynskey was cast as Leonardo DiCaprio's wife. Like a correct age for him. Yeah. And that was so nice to see him playing you know, an ordinary guy with adult sons. I really enjoyed that part as well. So yeah, I think this is something that it's kind of depressing to watch at Christmas, but then it, like Silent Night, which we discussed on a previous pod, it's this horrific setup, but the actual end result that you get from it is a sort of want to connect with mankind and be nice and be with your family and really sort of cherish them. So it's sort of one of those. Would you recommend people watch it at Christmas?
Well,
when you've had your turkey?
It's out on Christmas Eve, isn't it?
Yes.
So it's the big sort of film out on Netflix this Christmas. Perhaps an odd choice, but yeah, I'd say why the hell not? Because for me, I found it actually quite a cathartic experience watching it. I felt like, yes, someone out there kind of gets what we've all gone through over the last couple of years, the kind of insanity of the world right now. For me, it was really one of the sort of best just pieces of art that wrestled with the current moment that we're going through. I thought it had a real grasp of everything and just the insanity of it all. There's this great scene sort of two-thirds of the way through. It's sort of like Leo's network moment in a way where he kind of gives his monologue to the camera. And I just thought it was so exceptionally well written and performed. I just felt like, yeah, he really gets it. Like, finally, this is like what I've been screaming like from inside for like 2 years when all these just insane things were happening and no one was doing anything about it. Like, I felt like, oh, I'm not the only one. And it's also really interesting to watch through the lens of COVID as well, because
absolutely,
it's not a COVID film at all. Like, is COVID even mentioned?
No.
Like,
no,
it's not even part of it, is it? But the don't look up element of the film becomes this political mantra that's driven by this right-wing politician who's saying basically ignore science. And you look at that through the lens of COVID and anti-maskers and anti-vaxxers, and it's just the same. It's exactly the same metaphor. And this was written a year or more before COVID was even identified and shot during the pandemic. It's quite amazing just how well it reflects modern culture back, even when it didn't know what it was reflecting when it was created.
Absolutely, yeah. He's very clever. He's a very clever writer. And I think probably the caliber of the people that have come to join him on this project reflects the fact that other people think that too.
Juggles ensembles so well that everyone gets their moment. Not even Ariana Grande.
I'd forgotten about Ariana Grande.
Playing herself.
Yeah.
And Kid Cudi, they're on stage doing this ridiculous song.
But the lyrics are brilliant though.
Hilarious. Yeah, it is just a really funny film as well. Like, it gets dark. Like, it's about the end of the world, so it's not the cheeriest of films, but it's just so surreal and weird at points as well. Like, there's so many like funny, strange sight gags and like little ticker tapes on the bottom of the screens on news broadcasts, like just packed with jokes.
Yes.
There's this one joke that was killing me about like the inflation of the price of spades. Like,
yes,
if you just look
the
in the background, like spades are just going up in price constantly over the course of the film. So it's just like, what are people just like digging holes to like try and save themselves from annihilation? Just,
And then they have a woman on a newscast, don't they, saying, I wanted to get a spade and I couldn't get a spade. It's just like, there's just this joke about spades all the way through. Right at the beginning, you get that great joke where they call someone at NASA and they call like the head of the Interplanetary Commission of something. And they say, is that a real thing? And then there's a note card comes on screen and says, this is a real thing.
Yeah.
And here's their logo. And it's insane that there's a department of people that are actually in charge of this. Yeah, it's all of those things that you sort of love about in the thick of it as well, isn't it?
And
Veep, there's Veep elements of that, the sort of the bag carrying idiot, you know, like Jonah Hill's chief of staff who's always got his mum's handbag. It's all of those things that are all thrown in together with this quite serious message about, as humanity, how are we behaving when it comes to crisis, and how could we be better? Yeah, do you think this is going to bother the awards roster?
It's a tough one, because they're often a bit snooty about Netflix films still, aren't they?
And comedy as well.
Comedy,
it's sell, does it?
Yeah, it's kind of a double-edged sword in that case. Like, they might struggle to be recognized, but I think the script at least deserves it. It's a little overstuffed perhaps, but I think what he does, it feels incredibly incisive.
So that is Don't Look Up, which is out in cinemas on Friday, but then will be in your homes so you can enjoy it with your family on Christmas Eve on Netflix.
How festive.
Very festive. Okay, so now it's time for a quick alternative line reading. I don't know if you'll get this, but there is a link to a film we've talked about this week, and I'm going to do this in the style of a little old lady. Oh. What is your father, dear? Is he a coal miner? Does he stink of the lamp? You know how quickly the boys found you, all those tedious, sticky fumblings in the back seats of cars, while you could only dream of getting out, getting anywhere, getting all the way to the FBI.
Yeah, I know this one. Yeah, that's very good. Do you know, Matthew? Do you want to go?
Yeah, I think so.
What is it?
Is it Point Break?
Yes. No, it is not.
No, I know what it is.
It's Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, of course.
It is Silence of the Lambs. Yeah. To link with lamb, you see, it's a sheep theme.
How smart.
So there we go.
I have to say, I do love that scene. That scene's incredible.
Yes.
When he's giving Clarice a dressing down.
All the way to the FBI.
British thefts have a good way of saying FBI, don't they? Because Alan Rickman says, what is it he says in Die Hard? He says, I give you the FBI.
We enunciate our acronyms, don't we?
Yeah,
so
beautifully.
We have to say FBI. Okay, and this is what it sounds like for real.
Do you know what you look like to me with your good bag and your cheap shoes? You look like a rube. A well-scrubbed, hustling rube with a little taste. Good nutrition's given you some length of bone, but you're not more than one generation from poor wire trash, are you, Agent Starling? And that accent you've tried so desperately to shed, pure West Virginia. What is your father, dear? Is he a coal miner? Does he stink of the lamp? And oh, how quickly the boys found you. All those tedious, sticky fumblings in the backseats of cars, while you could only dream of getting out, getting anywhere, getting all the way to the FBI.
Okay, time for our final film, and it's this.
Hvem er undersøkelsen? Viser en større svulst.
Og så ønsker han, ja, tilbake nå i fryndelig grad. Skål da.
Skål.
Skål.
Skål,
mamma.
Det kan ikke kureres.
Så dette er håp. And we said it was a tragicomic cancer Christmas movie, Matthew. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes, that's not inaccurate. It's a couple, Thomas, played by Stellan Skarsgård, and his wife, Anya. And she's diagnosed with terminal cancer. And she effectively has 6 months to live. And so as we play out over these 6 months, they basically reevaluate and reassess their relationship, which is quite a tricky, complicated thing. They've kind of fallen into routine quite a lot. They're both sort of focused on work. There's a lot of history there between them. They have six children between them from different relationships. And so it's as much a terminal illness film as a film about, it's a portrait of a marriage. And we kind of follow it day by day almost up until a crucial turning point.
That sounds really grim,
yes.
But actually it's really darkly funny as well, isn't it?
Yeah, like a lot of terminal illness films, it does kind of weirdly lend itself to these sudden dark moments of comic release of tension. And it's incredibly heartwarming as well. I mean, it is set at Christmas. It kind of coincides with Christmas, and there are some really, really lovely moments.
It was based on the real experience of the writer-director, Maria Sodal, who actually was diagnosed with a brain cancer and had a certain amount of time to live just very suddenly. And it's this sense as well with this film, which I think we can all relate to, that you just don't have time for this. You know, you've got such a busy, busy life. Yeah. And then someone says, you've been diagnosed with brain cancer. And you're like, well, I just don't have time for that. I've got so many other things to do. And that sort of idea of the absolute bomb that something like that detonates in, not just the life of the person who's been given the diagnosis, but all of the extended family and friends that are trying to deal with that as well. And I think I found it funny, but as you say, extremely heartwarming. And incredibly, it's called Hope for a reason. It is incredibly hopeful despite this terrible diagnosis. And also, I think it's the first time I've seen Stellan Skarsgård play this kind of role. He's just watchful and he's just reacting to everything that's going on. I don't think I've seen him play that sort of befuddledness before.
Yeah.
And I found him very watchable because you totally relate to him as, what would you do? What would you say to somebody who'd been given that news? How do you deal with it? How can you help them? And so he's sort of the comic relief because he's always getting it wrong.
Yeah.
Of course he is. Because what's the right thing to say to him?
Yeah,
what's
the trying constantly. You know,
buys the wrong present, does the wrong thing on a hairdresser's, just does it wrong. And his little crestfallen face when he's done it wrong.
Mm.
But just the beauty as well in the fact that he totally accepts that and isn't upset that, you know, he's been snapped at, because there's no way to negotiate this. There's no book on this. There's no rule book. So yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. Jordan, would you fancy it?
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds terrific. I love the idea that it's not just a downer. It sounds like there's a bit of gallows humour to it all, and that I always appreciate in films like this.
Yeah. And the other thing that's quite interesting about it as well, I talked to Stellan Skarsgård about this after I'd seen it, was he said that all of the people who play the doctors and nurses are real doctors and nurses
they give
that news. So the way they're giving that news and the way that they're discussing it with the actors is exactly as they would. So all of those scenes feel incredibly authentic for that reason. And actually when they go to a hospice to look at a hospice, the woman that talks to them and sort of talks to them about palliative care is actually the very woman that the director had to speak to when she went. So it's really intensely personal for her, but also just feels incredibly unsensational in that way.
It's quite mundane, isn't it, in its way, but that does feel so believable. And there's no music in it at all. It's very low key. There's no real sort of showboaty moments, but it is incredibly affecting at the same time.
It's not designed to tug at the heartstrings. It's very, this is what happens, and these are the things that happen to you when you're taking your meds, and this is, you know, what happens when you go to hospital, and this is how the news would be delivered, and it isn't going to be sensational and dramatic music in the background. And also you see the real, I mean, again, this is probably because of the last couple of years we've had, but you really see the sensitivity and the wonderful way that medical staff are doing that. You know, they're having to give people terrible news day in, day out, and the way they do it, you know, some of them, the kindest way is just not to mess about with it, but just tell you
just
straight.
Be direct, answer questions directly.
So I found it really fascinating. And as I say, it is hopeful. It's not horrific. So I would highly recommend this one as well.
I would, yeah.
Interesting year for Stellan Skarsgård. This and The Worst Person in the Universe
Baron.
In June.
Yes. I mean, I think this is probably the more comfortable role for him, given that he really didn't enjoy sitting in the Baron's fat suit and having a pipe up his bottom to pump air and water into his suit.
Less weird oil baths.
Yeah, some weird oil baths and being hung from ceilings. Mm. This one, he gets to have lovely Scandinavian Christmas, eating and drinking and looking at twinkly lights and things like that. It's a much more comfortable
Bed a lot of the time.
So in bed, having lots of snoozing. Yeah, much better for him. But yeah, he's great. So we will recommend this one. This is Hope, and this is out in cinemas from this Friday. Okay, that's it for this week. Packed week. I mean, so much to watch. What's your film of the week, Jordan?
I'm going to have to go with Don't Look Up, which I thought was just, terrific. I would actually say it's worth seeking out in the cinema as well, because one aspect of the film we actually didn't talk about was that it's almost like an Armageddon pastiche as well, like a spoof, because there are these scenes where they send like rockets into space and stuff, and all that stuff is like quite big scale, dramatic VFX driven sequences. So it's worth seeking out on the big screen as well.
Okay. Matthew, what would you say?
It'd be a tie for me between Don't Look Up and Hope.
Okay. I would say I really enjoyed Lamb, and I would probably say Hope as well, because I thought it was incredibly moving. Okay, before we go, it's time for a reader's question. What's the best film featuring red in its title?
Very specific question.
Yeah.
What's this relate to Clifford the Big Red Dog?
Maybe.
Red Notice.
Maybe Clifford sent it in. And obviously Red Notice is like the most viewed film on earth at the moment. Yeah.
I don't think Don't Look Up's going to challenge that, sadly.
Oh, it's a shame.
You never know.
Yeah. They needed some aviator gin in Don't Look Up, and then maybe it would have.
Yeah.
Jordan.
Can I have two, please?
Yes.
So my first one is a bit of a cheat because it's Red Rocket, which is a film that isn't actually out yet, but has been at festivals and I saw about a month ago, which is Sean Baker's new film about a kind of washed up porn star who goes home and discovers, you know, the next big thing and is in Texas City. And I just thought it was tremendous. I really loved it. Like, keep an eye out for that one. And my other is SAS Red Notice.
Because you're in it.
I wonder why.
There's nothing to do with it. It's nothing to do with the fact that I am a co-star in this film. No, I'm not a co-star. I'm an extra who appears on screen for approximately 0.2
seconds.
You do
some excellent carrying of a case, though, through security.
I've been through a lot of airport and train station security carrying a bag. So I think I did it quite authentically. I think I was impressed that I did it as well as I did, to be honest. So yeah, that's mainly the reason I picked that, if I'm honest.
Very good.
The film's okay.
Okay. Matthew, favourite film with red in the title?
I'm going to go for two as well.
Go on.
Thin Red Line, Terrence Malick's big World War II comeback.
I was expecting one of you to pick that, of course.
And The Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, is that allowed? I mean, it's got a character called Red in it.
Exactly.
Maybe that's how we're supposed to say it, and we've all been saying it wrong this whole time.
This is a revelation.
Okay. I'm going to go for Red Rock West.
Ooh, oh, yeah.
And also The Red Shoes.
Of course.
Two bangers.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good films with red in them.
There is. I mean, I can
see why they asked this
red
question.
Dawn?
Red Dawn. The original, you mean?
The original. The Swayze, not the Hemsworth.
Yeah. The less said about that, the better.
Three Colors Red.
The red one was good out of the blue and white.
So it's my fave out of those.
Big Red One with the young one. Mark Hamill.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Well, there we go. If you have any other red films you'd like to inform us are the best red films, let us know via Twitter. But for now, we're going to go off and think of some more and possibly maybe do another question about blue films.
Could cover the whole rainbow.
We could. We might do that. Okay, that's what the rest of our day holds for us. We hope that you'll be back next week to listen to what we have next week, because we have a Spider-Man screening coming up.
Oh my God.
What? Spoilers. It's coming.
I can't wait to see all those Spider-Men on screen.
They're not going to be in them, Jordan. That's what they keep telling us.
Yeah, Andrew Garfield, definitely not in that film.
Definitely not.
Nicholas Hammond.
See.
That's the one I'm going to see.
We will see. Okay, so for now, let's say goodbye and we will be back next week. Say goodbye, Jordan.
Bye.
Say goodbye, Matthew.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You got me on.